You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Okay, we're going to get started right now. Welcome, everyone, to Session 4, which is Innovations in Practice. We're very excited about this session because it's really going to give us the chance to ground the day's discussions of innovative educational practice in some really concrete examples from the ground. This session is really about transforming and bringing to life the word innovation that we've been using all day and perhaps not always defining. So today, over the course of the next hour, in both this room and the room across the hall, three different innovators are going to take the stage and share with you their stories and their innovations. They're each going to really try to tell you how it is that they've made their innovations come to life and what it's doing to transform and leapfrog the experiences of learners across the world. After this session, though, you're going to have the chance to interact with all of the innovators, both the ones in this room and the ones across the hall, at our Innovations Fair, which is going to be in the Summers Room, right to the right of the staircase when you come into Brookings. And although we won't have any question and answer time in this session, and although, unfortunately, we won't get to see the wonderful innovators across the hall, we're going to have that 5 to 6 p.m. session to really get to know everyone. So without further ado, I will introduce the first of our three presenters, Claudio Sasaki. Claudio's experience in education began with the creation of Movimento Jovem, an NGO focused on developing kids' interpersonal skills. A Brazilian national, he co-founded the adaptive learning platform, Geeky, after a career in investment banking. His platform has since come to serve over 10 million learners across Brazil and improved learning outcomes significantly. Today, he'll be talking to us about Geeky and the power of individualized learning. So let's welcome Claudio to the stage.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Claudio Sasaki. It's an honor to be here to share a little bit with you of what we are doing with Geeky. And, oops. That's not me. That was not planned, though.
So instead... Yay, Claudio! Let's give a round of applause. So instead, let us welcome to the stage Linda Lucas. Yes, let's give her a big round of applause first. Linda is a programmer, a storyteller, and an illustrator from Finland. While learning to program, she began to draw pictures to help her grapple with the coding challenges she faced. These pictures featured a little girl named Ruby and eventually became the basis for a children's coding book that has since been translated into over 25 languages. She'll be teaching us today about her Hello Ruby method and sharing why and how we might come to fall in love with technology. So let's welcome Linda.
Beautiful. Wonderful. So my name is Linda. I'm a children's book author. I'm an illustrator. I'm a programmer. I'm originally from Helsinki, Finland. And I write children's books about technology. This is my thesis. If coding is the next universal language, we need more mics.
Okay, beautiful. So if coding is the next universal language, instead of grammar classes, we ought to be teaching poetry lessons. And with that, I mean that the same way we learn a natural language, not only by conjugating irregular verbs, we learn a natural language by speaking it, by reading it, by falling in love with random boys on the streets and flirting with it. Coding is not a natural language, but we need a much more diverse way and much more different pedagogical tools to teach it. So I write stories, and they started with this little girl over there called Ruby, who was kind of my alter ego growing up. But then I started to really see the world of technology for stories. So I imagined, what if Apple was a character? It would obviously be the snow leopard who's beautiful but doesn't want to play with the other kids because it only likes well-designed and nice things. And if Linux was a character, it would be the really book-smart penguin who's ruthlessly efficient but somewhat hard to follow. And I figured that there is this like area in coding education that is having this renaissance moment right now with everything the wonderful teams at Code.org and Scratch are doing. But where are the stories? Because stories, after all, are the way we learn about ourselves, about each other, and about the world around us. So as mentioned, I write stories about technology. I've written books about coding, about computers, about networks, and about artificial intelligence. And they've been translated into languages all over the world. But the thing I think about now, when I think about what I do, is I don't teach kids coding. I prepare them for a world where more and more of the problems around us are technology problems. And in order to solve the biggest and the hairiest problems in the world, we need a much more diverse group of people to get excited about all of the possibilities technology offers. So with that in mind, meet Ruby. She's 6 years old, completely fearless, a little bit bossy, very imaginative. And when Ruby's dad tells Ruby, "Oh, Ruby, we're running late from school, dress up really quickly," Ruby dresses up, but she leaves her pajamas on because dad didn't specifically first tell her to take the pajamas off. And when Ruby is told, "Oh, Ruby, your room is a mess, clean up all the toys," Ruby cleans up all the toys, but she leaves the pens and papers on the floor because, come on, Dad, pens and papers are not really toys. And it might be that I'm raising the most obnoxious generation of kids ever to this date, but they also learn of something very profound about how to speak to a computer. Namely, you need to be very careful when giving commands. The commands need to happen in the right sequence. You need to be careful when you name things. Take into account all kinds of situations that the computer might run into. And most importantly, the thing I'm most jealous for, a computer scientist, the idea that even the biggest problems in the world are tiny problems stuck together. So with that in mind, I wanted to kind of give you in this 12 minutes an ABC to technology education. And we start with A for algorithms. And I want you to actually be a part of this exercise, because like many of you who've studied pedagogy and education far longer than I know, you can't really offer a whole new area of content by only giving a pre-organized vocabulary. True learning is grounded in action, and that's especially true when we talk about such an abstract concept as computer science. So I want you to pair up in pairs of two. The other person is the computer. The other person is the programmer. The programmer's role is to give the computer instructions on how to brush their teeth. Not wash their teeth. That's my Finnishism over there. But brush their teeth. And remember what we just learned from Ruby. Computers only understand commands that are very clear. They need to be given, did you remember to open the toothpaste when you're going for the toothpaste? And so forth and so forth. So I'll give you roughly 1 minute to go, and then we'll review what happened. So programmer, coder, brushing teeth exercise. Okay, go. Seconds. Okay, let's wrap it up. Okay, hush, hush. Sorry, programmers, I'm the boss here. I decide. Hush, hush. Okay, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, eyes on me. How did the teachers go? Okay, how many made a mistake? Raise of hands. Amazing, let's celebrate that in a second. How many discussed with your partner about how to sort of make the program better? Amazing, not that many. Okay, so the reason why I'm raising these two points up is because they are so foundational in computer science. It might be that your program was good. It might be that you remembered to take the tooth, like cork away from the tooth paste. It might be that you remembered to stop the computer from moving its hand. But the far more fundamental lesson you just learned is two things that are so important in computer science that we even have a special name for them. The first thing, making mistakes, is called debugging. So no computer programmer makes perfect code at the get-go. So that's why we need a special word for the fact when you go back to your code and you try to find that annoying bug or problem in your code and you fix it out. And there's a lot of strategies on how you can do this. The other thing you just did was pair programming. So computer science is a collaborative effort. Two pairs of eyes sees better than one pair of eyes. And that's why we need to be talking. And then the final thing you just did is creativity. You worked together with your peers to solve a problem, and all of your programs look different from one another. So algorithms are what you also did. You did a step-by-step sequence to solve a problem. And when we think about it, recipes are algorithms. But it might be hard to make the connection into the world of computer science from here. What I'll show you next is how a computer would break down a problem like this into sequences. So if I asked you to sort these four numbers into order of magnitude, it would take you maybe 3 seconds. For a and if I asked you to do these ones, it would take you a little bit longer. But if I asked you to do all of these, it would take you far longer. For a computer, all of this is really fast and really easy. What a computer would do, it would start from the beginning, it would compare two numbers to one another and go like, oh, one is smaller than 56, let's keep it like that, 56 to 4, let's swap them around, 56 to 70, let's keep it like that, and 70 to 20, let's swap it again, and then it would start from the beginning. And this is called a bubble sort algorithm that a computer scientist wrote, a step-by-step instruction on how to sort numbers, for instance. And these algorithms are everywhere around us. They are in Google or Bing when we search for results. There's an algorithm that specifies which search orders you see. There's an algorithm that specifies what kind of ads you see on social networking sites or what kind of updates you get. And there's ads in the kinds of videos you're shown on YouTube. And this is the reason why having a very basic understanding of what algorithms are so fundamental to computer science. So the B I want to show you is for Boolean logic. And there's this famous saying that computer science has as much to do with computers as astronomy has to do with telescopes. But in some ways, the computer is a very profound character in this whole realm of science because it's at the core of computing. But computers, they've become these very abstract devices that seal a lot of complexity from us. They are these glowing boxes that we don't know how they work anymore. And sometimes I wish I could squeeze myself to the size of a silicone chip and learn how computers work from the inside out. And fortunately, that is possible if you're a children's book author. So I plunge Rubin into an adventure. She goes to Dad's office, she types her password in, but the computer doesn't work, and all of a sudden the white mouse wakes up next to Ruby and says, "Oh, Ruby, I've lost touch with the cursor. Can you help me find the cursor?" And Ruby says, "Of course, I'm the best computer debugger I know of." And together they fall deep, deep inside of the computer to the layer of the electricity where there's billions of tiny switches that only know how to go on and off, on and off. And little Ruby, she says, "Oh, these switches are not much use. I'll need to climb higher." So she meets the logic gates. And after that, she meets the CPU, the processor of the computer that is really good at bossing people around. And she meets the operating system. And finally, they do meet the cursor. But more importantly, she gets this very foundational idea of computers, not as magic machines, but as logic machines. So I think the most important thing I teach to kids is not coding skills, is ownership and sort of self-efficacy around technology. And a final example I want to share is this one. So I give kids these little stickers with an on-off button on them. And I tell to them, for this afternoon alone, you can make anything in this room into a computer by placing this sticker on it. And I've collected a motley collection of everyday items like tuna cans and shampoo bottles and lipsticks. And the kids, they first object and they say, "Linda, this is too difficult. I don't know the right answer for an exercise like this. And I tell them, neither does your parent. They might have just heard about this thing called IoT or the Internet of Things, but you guys are going to grow up in a world where your teddy bear is a computer, your toothbrush is a computer, and it's up to you to design that future. So a little girl comes to me, she's chosen a bicycle lamp, and she goes, Linda, if this bicycle lamp was a computer, we could go on a biking trip together with my father, we could sleep in a tent, and this bicycle lamp, it could also be a movie projector. And that's the moment I'm looking for. Not the moment when the kid understands the difference between arrays and hashes in Ruby programming language or writes the perfect if-else statement in JavaScript. The moment when they understand three very profound things that we adults have a hard time remembering. First of them is that the world is not ready yet. There's so much we haven't invented or discovered because the engineers think only about a certain set of problems, or the current engineers of the day. The second thing is that she realized that technology is a wonderful way to make the world a little bit better and a little bit more ready. And the third and most important thing was that she had for a moment there the self-efficacy, self-belief to think that she very well could be the world's first and best computer, bicycle lamp, movie projector innovator. So I'm going to stop with an idea about technology that a little girl told me. Technology is built on humanity, and computers, while we think about the world in this binary way that there's technology and there's us humans, we are actually intertwined because the first computers in the world, they were humans. The very last computers in the world will be, again, humans. Being a computer used to be a profession, and the word technology actually means the skills and competencies to solve problems. That comes from Greek. And one of the most beautiful descriptions of technology was given for me by a little 9-year-old girl who defined technology in this way. She told me that technology is electricity that loves. Technology is electricity that loves. It is used to play. I use it to have a conversation with my mom. We use a WhatsApp application. And then finally, and most importantly, people use technology. That's what I want you to remember. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Linda, for sharing your story and the story of Ruby. Up next, we do have Claudio, in fact. So you've already heard all about Claudio. Thank you for welcoming him. He's going to tell us about Geeky, the adaptive learning technology.
Well, I hope it works now. Well, good afternoon. My name is Claudio Sasaki. I was a teacher for about 7 years, then changed careers, and never thought I was going to be working with education again until I had kids and moved back to Brazil. And so they are a big part of the story of why Geeky exists. So there you go. Ooh. Brazil is a country which, in my view, I think the biggest problem is the unequal access to high-quality education, right? We live in a country where roughly 85% of the kids are in public schools. And so when I saw the possibility of using technology to personalize learning, I mean, for me, it was just a big call. And when we... if you heard about Geeky, you probably heard about the adaptive platform in which we reach students directly. And through that platform, over the last few years, we've reached roughly more than 10 million students throughout the country. There are, in 99% of the cities in Brazil today, there is someone studying with our platform, and primarily through their cell phones, 60% women, 40% men. So that's the impact we have had. But when we look at Brazil, and most people don't know, but it's a country in which the dropout ratio in high school is roughly close to 50%. Out of those who finish, approximately 10% learn the basics in Portuguese and math. So for us, I mean, it was a rude awakening. It's personalization is not only through reaching students directly, But I think what we've been spending a lot of time is how can we do that inside the classroom. So that's what I'm going to talk about today. And what I want to talk about is about heroes, right? Superheroes, and which we also call teachers. And what I want to tell is a little bit of a story of a typical teacher in Brazil. You may be familiar with, but Vinicius, he's one of the 2 million teachers in Brazil. He earns approximately $1,000 per month on average. And just like him, there's roughly 99% of the teachers earn that same salary. He's married, two little girls, and to be able to afford his living, he has to work in roughly two or three schools at the same time. So that's his routine. So he barely has any spare time to spend with his family and friends. And when we look at his week, let's see his Saturday and Sunday. I mean, unfortunately, he starts the week or the weekend not being able to spend that much time with his family because hopefully he will prepare his classes, right? And so, of course, the material that he has doesn't provide all the materials he needs to turn the classroom into a more engaged classroom. The number one reason that students claim in Brazil for dropout is the lack of interest and connection between the classroom and real life. So that's his challenge. So he spends a lot of time over the weekend, you know, browsing content online, videos, etc., to try to prepare his classes. When it comes to Monday, 7 in the morning, it's an early day. He still has at least five or six more classes in that particular school. He may work three shifts, morning, afternoon, and evening. And so it's already 7:20, 7:25, and he hasn't really started to teach because he still needs to spend time checking attendance, checking homework. And in Brazil, usually a third of the time that teachers spend in the classroom is with other stuff other than, you know, teaching and learning. So, of course, it is frustrating because when it comes to Tuesday, he needs to continue covering content because that's what he's supposed to do. And then he realizes that half of the class, you know, at best, is just not keeping up with what he taught yesterday. So he needs to stop and go back and try to remediate with those students that are still lagging behind. It's not only his problem because they're probably lagging behind for a long time, but he needs to do something. And then so it's boring, of course, for the students that theoretically mastered yesterday's content because, you know, they're just there listening or pretending they're listening. When it comes to Wednesday, that's a tough day because he has three schools that he teaches and he needs to prepare exams, right? So one exam per class. So it's probably going to cost him about 4 hours of his days to prepare. And we're not only talking about preparing, but correcting those tests, you know, takes a lot of time. And then Thursday, I mean, it's frustrating because he's struggling in the morning with classes. And then in the afternoon, he has PD or he has, you know, group discussions. And usually the pedagogical coordinator is not up to date. He doesn't have the data available. He doesn't know what's going on. So it's a little bit frustrating. When he talks to his peers, they also don't, you know, the curriculum, at least in Brazil, is not fully integrated. Teachers just kind of follow their own stuff. So it seems like everyone is fighting their own battles. So loneliness, a lot of work. When it comes to Friday, you know, it's frustration. He's exhausted, of course. And it's not only frustration, but it's also a little bit of sadness, right? Because at the end of the day, his students are not learning. And when you think about Brazil, it's roughly 50 million students in K-12. And again, the learning outcomes, just by any metrics you look, I mean, Brazil is struggling as a country. So at the end of the day, students are not learning. How could this be different? And so this is just one alternative. Of course, there are many, but this is what we believe. So Saturday, Sunday, it's usually 10 minutes he has to look at data. And if that data comes in a way that makes his life easier, of course, he will use it. And then instead of spending time looking for good quality content over the internet, if we can support and provide that content already to him. So he has the ownership to choose what he wants to use. And just by looking at the data, he knows how his students are, more or less, so he can kind of tailor the difficulty of this content to his students so he can start the week in a different way. So Monday, he would use a platform. It's a flexible curriculum that introduces the topic to his class. And I think at the end of the day, a good thing to do would be to have a little assessment to see, you know, where students are. Based on that data, and he doesn't need to correct because the information comes already corrected. His job is not to correct, but is to get that information so he can use it on a daily basis. When it comes to Tuesday, one of the options is, and we are talking about personalized learning here, is divide this classroom into three different groups. So one group is going to be a targeted small instruction, which is essentially spending time with him, addressing individual needs. The other group, what we are calling independent study, it could be a project, it could be an activity together. It's really not only mastering content, but it's really empowering students to work together on something that not only covers content, but also develop their skills. And then the last one is what we are calling digital content station, is really targeting or bringing content that is at the level that students need and that they choose to cover. So you also exercise ownership here. So the point is, instead of having only 50 minutes with the students, we are multiplying his time by at least two or three, right? So we're talking about 100 or 150 minutes with the class. So on Wednesday, he continues to do this station rotation methodology. By the afternoon, he's already experimenting another feature that we could help him, which is a feature to quickly produce assessments. Since you already have the data, I mean, you can suggest assessments that are very much aligned with each of the classrooms that he teaches. If he would do that manually, of course, it would take a lot of time. That's why we believe in using technology to save teachers time and make it more efficient. So when it comes to Thursday, of course, the meeting with his pedagogical coordinator is much more interesting because the coordinator has real-time data, has already thought about suggestions to work together with him so he can address or create specific strategies to work with his students, the work with the teachers. There's a lot of room now to talk about interaction since this platform, the curriculum is flexible. They can work together, you know, cross activities on the same topic together. So that makes a lot of sense for the students who are receiving that content. And then on Friday, I mean, it's really the end of the week. I think it's much more excitement, not only because he feels that students are learning, because the level of engagement is totally different from what he used to be. And of course, he deserves to go home, spend time with his family, and fulfill his role as a father. And I mean, I think it's just to make it clear, when we think about personalization at the school level, I mean, the technology piece or the platform piece is just one piece of the puzzle. I think what we have learned over these years is to do that in large scale, we're really talking about school redesign, right? It's thinking about not only the technology that needs to be flexible, but also targeted instruction, it's also data-driven decisions, and it's also empowering students to work alone and to reflect about their own accomplishments. So, in a nutshell, this is what we do. I mean, what we realize is technology, it can be very powerful as long as it's used to support, you know, the works of the superheroes, which are the teachers. Thank you.
Thank you, Claudio, for sharing Geeky with us. So last but not least, we have Karima Grant. Karima is a Senegalese-American born in New York City, and she spent decades serving learners across two continents. Her career in education began as a preschool teacher in Harlem, New York, and eventually took her to her parents' home country of Senegal. While teaching there, she noticed a profound lack of creative learning opportunities, and that's what led her to found in 2011 Imagination Africa. This afternoon, she is going to explore with us the value of playful learning and how Imagination Africa is bringing these sorts of creative experiences to learners across the nation. So let's welcome Karima.
So, hello, everyone. Come on, hello.
Hello.
Because this is what we're talking about. We're talking about people, right? I really appreciated Vishal's comments earlier about really why are we educating people. So as Adam mentioned, in 2003, I made the decision to return to Senegal. My mother's from Senegal. Senegal, if you don't know, is a small country on the westernmost tip of Africa. We're very well known, actually, right now because of music and, you know, we're kind of on the map. We'll be in the World Cup. That's your opportunity to applaud, please. Thank you. Very good, thank you. And in 2003, I returned. I was an educator. I'd worked in Harlem, serving some of the most disadvantaged communities. And in 2003, when we made this decision to return, myself and my husband, who was also an educator, we went to work in one of the country's top private schools, right? And one of the most prestigious programs in the world, actually, in the school. And so we were, of course, very, very excited because, of course, we met some of the most intelligent children, some of the children who were scoring the best in the country. And I was just all set to write home to everybody and say, we have solved the educational problem. What we cannot do in the U.S., we're doing here in Senegal. I just want to put this in perspective. 60% of our population is under 25. 60%. So there I am with the best and the brightest in the country, and I'm so surprised because they're outscoring people, they're getting into top U.S. universities, but they're unable to imagine an Africa prosperous, thriving. They're unable to even imagine how we can get water in our capital city to be flowing 24 hours a day. Because that's the reality of where we are in Africa, right? So here's some more statistics, just to put this all in perspective, right? So we have 0 to 14-year-olds, we have about 41%, 20%, right, 15 to 24%. And this is the reality for those other students who are not in the top schools, right? 63% cannot read, 78% cannot perform basic math skills. So if the top, the most elite in the country, can't figure this out, what are we saying to ourselves as a nation? How are we imagining development? So for me, I taught for about 5 years, and then I was very lucky to be able to transition to work as transformative leadership trainer. Transformative leadership trainer, we're the people, particularly if you're in the private sector or you're in the ONG, the NGO world, we're the ones you call out when you do team buildings and you want everybody to kind of work better, how to solve organizational issues. So I would call out, and I was very excited. I really had a wonderful career working across Africa with different kinds of teams. But then again, there was the same problem, right? The continent's best and brightest, sometimes even working in our ministries, were unable to problem solve, to imagine the ends of projects, to be able to critically think, to even communicate and collaborate. And I began to think the problem was not necessarily with these children, but as I once heard, but with the environment. If we're trying to grow anything, I don't know how many of you are gardeners, even weekend gardeners. If you have a problem growing a flower, what do? Right, you treat the soil, you treat the water. And for me, what I began to do was to begin to look at the environment that was surrounding children. And I realized that the thing that was missing from our environment was play. In our rush toward development, we were not honoring or understanding play. Play, as we all know, not only develops children's confidence, social skills, enhances creativity, but play is the way that human beings train their brains. We have research now that's demonstrating that as little as young as 6 months, we are challenging our brains and we're promoting our brain development through play. So for us, in 2003, I founded Imagination Africa with the idea of transforming how African children understand themselves and their contribution to development. So I'm just going to pause there, because I want you to understand what we're really doing with Imagination Africa. So I'm going to ask everybody just to get up, stand up. Make sure you have enough room to do like this with your hands, please. Okay. I'm going to try to do this with the mic. I don't think it's going to work, but we'll try to see. I'm so glad Adam's telling me my voice is not loud enough. My husband disagrees. So it's great. Okay. So very simple, this game, okay? Please go like this with your hands and repeat after me. Big fish.
Big fish.
Okay? In Senegal, our big fish is called a chof. Chof is also the name we call for a very attractive man. Okay, so when I say big fish, you will go like this. Big fish?
Chuff.
Very good, chuff. She got it. Big fish?
Chuff.
Big fish?
Chuff.
Big fish?
Chuff.
Big fish?
Chuff.
Very good. Now, go like this with your hands. That is small fish. Okay, small fish in Senegal. We call a yaboy, but many people who come from poorer communities know it's the fish that's very skinny with a lot of bones, but it's usually the very tastiest fish, right? We won't talk about the men we call yaboys. So you keep your hands like this. This is small fish.
Yaboy.
Small fish.
Yaboy.
Yaboy, very good. Small fish.
Yaboy.
Small fish.
Yaboy.
Okay, very good. Can you hear me? Okay. The point of this game is to do what I say and not what I do. Very easy, yes? When I say big fish, what will you do? When I say little fish or small fish, what will you do? Very good. Ready? He really thinks I need this. I love Adam. Thank you. Perfect. Ready? Again, you're going to do what I say and not what I do. Right? Let's go. Big fish, small fish. Big fish, small fish. Big fish, small fish. Big fish, small fish. Excellent. Very good. Give yourselves a round of applause. All right. Go a little faster, right? Because we've rested, we've eaten, we've talked about things, our brains are buzzing, right? Here we go. Ready? And big fish, small fish. Big fish, small fish. Small fish, big fish. Some of you are just lost. It's a little early to get lost in the game. Let's try again. Big fish, small fish. Small fish, big fish. Small fish, small fish, small fish, small fish. I adore you. She just stood there for a while and looked around and said, I don't think I'm doing this right. Let me change my hands. One last time. Come on, we can do this, can't we? Yes? He's looking at me. He's like, please, not now. Why? Why? Shall we again?
Yeah.
All right, here we go. Big fish, small fish. Big fish, small fish. Small fish, big fish. Big fish, small fish. Small fish, big fish. Big fish. Small fish. He was just unsure. He was just like, well, how about medium fish? All right, so thank you all very much. What was happening in that game? Some of you got it. What was happening? Sir, can I ask you? Do we have another mic somewhere? Okay. Can we ask him? What was happening in that game? There, right there. I'm putting you on the spot.
Well, you were testing my listening. That's why I wasn't looking at you.
Why didn't you look at me?
I didn't look at you.
Why didn't you?
Because I was listening to you.
Uh-huh.
And you said, don't do what you say. I mean, don't do what you do,
yes,
but what you say.
Very good.
So I'm listening to what you say.
Very good. Many of you got lost because you were looking at me, right? And we have a great paradigm in our head that says what? Seeing is believing, right? One of the challenges is that the human mind, and this is where research and learning comes in, is the human mind doesn't function that way. Believing is seeing. We see the world as we believe it. And so for African children growing up in spaces where we don't see African engineers and African mathematicians and Africans building bridges, and we see teachers, African teachers, in poor classrooms, the work that we do as Imagination Africa has to include changing these paradigms. So this is what we do. We change paradigms. Oops, right here, sorry. This is the work that we do. We're a values-based organization. These are our core values: child-centered, play, global thinking, local partners, and accessibility. What we do is we bring play-based learning to develop problem-solving and critical thinking skills. We work with pre-primary and primary school, focusing tremendously on early learning. We use arts and cultures, and we also have one of Dakar and Senegal's first maker spaces. We call it a hub, because we had a lot of problems using the word a children's museum. But essentially, we have a children's museum. It's a hub for children's learning and innovation. It's one of the first in West Africa. And what we use is local culture. Because as we're talking about shifting paradigms, we want children and the ecosystem around children to really understand that local culture has everything we need for learning. Learning is not something that needs to be imported. And that things that are, for instance, our local tailor shops, our local marketplaces, are all spaces to reinforce mathematics, to reinforce critical thinking. We also, because we have an ecosystem approach, and we believe so deeply that because learning is anchored in the reality that's surrounding around children, we always work to develop community members and local expertise to deliver programming so that they begin to understand themselves of how do we hold learning, particularly 21st century learning. Again, because we have an ecosystem approach, we work with local institutions. We work with public spaces and municipal governments to become stronger learning spaces for children. We develop programs that increase accessibility for children. This actually is one of our an example of the impact we're having. This year, just actually about 3 months ago, we signed a partnership with the Ministry of Culture in Senegal. Every 2 years, Senegal hosts an international art exhibition called the Dakar Biennale. And for this year, we were chosen to actually help connect this international art exhibition to the local community, the local curriculum that children are using, and to create spaces that made it accessible. So for us, this was an example of creating learning spaces in public spaces and making sure that the responsibility of children's learning wasn't just happening by the Ministry of Culture. That's there. This is where I'll leave you with. This kind of paradigm thinking through play, this kind of reflection that we just did through this game is probably at the heart of what we do. We work to develop teachers and other educational professionals through teacher development and the creation of resources. We make teachers play. We work to change the paradigms of what is a teacher, what is their role, what is learning, and what is play. I think we heard it earlier, one of the challenges that we're not asking ourselves, particularly in African and other developing countries, is what is the point of education? What is the point of learning? And so we have those kind of very in-depth kind of teacher development programs where we focus a lot on who the teacher is being and how much the teacher's being impacts how students learn. And this is us. We promote creative thinking and problem solving through play because we believe that play is what's going to develop Africa's future. So thank you all very much.
Thank you so much, Karima. Let's have one last big round of applause for all of our innovators.